I have, that I appreciate the hospitality that has been shown me here in Wichita Falls and in these studies. One year I stayed with the D. Tate family, and another year with the Jack Woodruffs. This year with Sister Lena Mae Gudgeon. And another year I was scheduled or invited to stay with the Charles Gudgeons. And so I appreciate very much the hospitality and the good meals that the sisters provide too here at the study. To my knowledge, this subject has not been discussed before in a study. Brother Johnny Elmore had one several years ago on the church and institutionalism. And so parts of it would be studied there. But just this subject here alone has not been studied in the study. Now my subject is, what is the church's responsibility to non-believers, orphans, in benevolence? By way of introduction, let me make it clear in the beginning that the position that I wish to expound on this subject is a matter of Bible authority. Truth cannot be determined by appeals to our emotions or by making prejudicial arguments. If this question is to be decided on the basis of emotionalism, I concede defeat, and I concede it right now. If emotionalism is the criterion, I can't prove to the sectarians that baptism and church membership are essential to salvation, because they'll tell me somebody that there never was a Christian who was baptized during the church as good as their grandma or good as their grandpa. But you know, by the Bible, I can prove it essential. Let it be clearly understood that I'm not advocating today the neglect of orphan children or any needy person. And if there's anyone in the entire world that stirs my emotions, it's a child who has neither father or mother or loving personal relatives who will supply his or her physical, emotional, and spiritual needs. If there's anybody who would come close to tapping my emotions on a similar subject, it would be an elderly person who has no one to take care of them. It's been repeatedly said that the care of orphans is what started the churches of Christ on the road of institutionalism. Emotions are the volatile fuels for prejudice. Here are the ways such advocates fan the emotions and prove their practice. Quote, oh, they can take money out of the church treasury to buy horse manure to go on the preacher's lawn, but not a dime to help a non-Christian. Or, quote, they can find room in the budget of the church where they preach for their salary for an expense account, a $75,000 building, air conditioning, a janitor, a lawnmower, a preacher's home, and many other things which exhaust the offering. But they cannot find a place for one little orphan child who has not been baptized. As far as they are concerned, it can starve to death in the streets before one dime of money can be spent on it from a church treasury. May the Lord deliver me from any such religion as that. Unquote. You see what I mean about emotions? When emotions become embroiled, people don't ask what saith the Scriptures. When it deals with war, when it deals with racial prejudice, when it deals with worship, and on you can go. When emotions become involved, people don't care what that book says. So I repeat, if this question is to be decided on the basis of emotionalism, I concede defeat, and I concede it now. We can save our time. Please observe that in every case of benevolence where a church or churches engaged in helping the needy, the needy ones are always, without exception, spoken of as saints. The church in Antioch sent relief to the needy churches in Judea. We read in Acts 11, 27 through 30, and in these days came prophets from Jerusalem unto Antioch, and there stood up one of them named Agabus, and signified by the Spirit that there should be great dearth throughout all the world, which came to pass in the days of Claudius Caesar. Then the disciples, every man according to his ability, determined to send relief unto the brethren which dwelt in Judea. which also they did, and sent it to the elders by the hands of Barnabas and Saul. Luke says the disciples in Antioch determined to send relief to the brethren, not a word of relief for the people of the world. At a later time, the church in Jerusalem reached the point where it could not take care of its own needy. So Paul gave the Gentile churches orders to send help to the needy saints. Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I have given order to the churches in Galatia, even so do ye. Upon the first day of the week, let every one of you lay by him in store as God hath prospered him, that there be no gatherings when I come. 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2. Who was the collection for? Paul said, saints. But someone will say, and so I'll answer this ahead of time, what if there was a man or a woman who was a saint, but had some children who were old enough, but had not yet obeyed the gospel? Could any of the money go to her or him? Yes, indeed. All the church would be doing was helping him or her to fulfill their responsibility as a parent. Anyone ought to be able, I believe, to see that such case would by no means place the responsibility upon the church to take care of the needy world. In Romans 15 and 25, Paul says, but now going to Jerusalem to minister to the saints. So once more, the help from the Gentile churches was for the poor saints. Again, we learn that the churches of Macedonia who were taking part in sending relief to Jerusalem prayed that Paul would take upon himself, quote, the fellowship of ministering to the saints, 2 Corinthians 8 and 4. Then in 2 Corinthians 9 and 1 we read, for as touching the ministering to the saints, it is superfluous for me to write to you. It is saints in every case. There are more scriptures that we'll notice along this line, but first, I wish to notice some misapplied scriptures that are used to support the idea that the treasury is not for the saints only, and that is doing good unto all men. I believe that with an honest and sincere study of the scriptures, we can find out what Paul meant by the phrase, unto all men, as the King James says, in connection with the relief funds that were for the needy saints in Jerusalem. The passage where the phrase is used is 2 Corinthians, the 9th chapter and the 13th verse. We read in the King James, whilst by the experiment of this ministration, they glorify God for your professed subjection unto the gospel of Christ and for your liberal distribution unto them and unto all men. Men is italicized in my King James Bible right here. That is, it's a supplied word and it's not in the original. In other words, distribution unto all. The New American Standard Version says, because of the proof given by this ministry, they will glorify God for your obedience to your confession of the gospel of Christ and for the liberality of your contribution to them and to all. Now, if, as some teach, if the relief went literally unto all men, it was one well of a contribution. It would have been large enough to go to every man in need, and not a want was left unsupplied to either saint or sinner. Even on its face value, I believe that no man can accept such a conclusion. Therefore, all men must be limited. I believe every person on face value will limit all men, and they have in every debate that I've read who take that other side. The chapter tells us exactly who received the help. Verse 1 says, for as touching the ministering to the saints, it didn't say to saints and sinners. Verse 12 says, it supplied the, quote, want of the saints. It didn't say it supplied the want of the saints and sinners. The money was collected for the saints. 1 Corinthians 16 and verse 1, an alien is not a saint. Did Paul tell them the collections were for the saints in the 16th chapter of 1 Corinthians? And then come over in the 2 Corinthians and say, but I gave it to somebody else. Now, it's for the saints, but I gave it to somebody else. Did Paul deceive them? What does 2 Corinthians 9 and 13 teach? First of all, If you will understand that this collection of funds from the Gentile churches was primarily for the Jewish saints, but not exclusively so, I believe you'll have no trouble understanding the phrase, and unto all. This statement would include Gentile saints. They were the all when such relief was needed. Secondly, observe that Paul speaks of this relief from the Gentile churches to the needy Jewish saints as an experiment. Now, an inspired experiment, of course, and not something that Paul thought up on his own. It's implied by the word experiment in this verse that there existed an aloofness or coolness on the part of the Jewish Christians toward the Gentile Christians. Paul hoped and prayed that these relief funds from these Gentile churches would help to remove this aloofness on the part of the Jewish Christians towards the Gentile churches. Although Paul makes it clear to the Corinthians that their giving on the first day of the week would be for the needy Jewish saints, but he also included Gentile saints when he used the phrase, and unto all men, or unto all. Paul knew the coolness of the Jewish Christians towards Gentile Christians, that it was so great that he asked the brethren in Rome to pray that my service which I have for Jerusalem may be accepted of the saints. In Romans 15, verses 30 and 31. It was so cool until he asked them to pray that they would accept it from the Gentiles. Thirdly, in Romans 15, verses 25 through 27, Paul makes it crystal clear that the collections made on the first day of the week by the members of these Gentile churches was earmarked for the Jewish saints in Jerusalem. Now, the saving gospel, according to God's plan, had been brought to the Gentile people by and through the Jewish saints. There, the Gentile believers owed the Jewish saints a great debt of gratitude. This relief from these Gentile churches, Paul hoped and prayed, would help to remove the aloofness on the part of Jewish saints toward the Gentile Christians, and thus bring them closer together. With all of these scriptures before us, which declare that the relief from all the Gentile churches was for the needy saints, we must conclude that the phrase, and unto all, means saints, and not just the Jewish ones then, as I might illustrate it here with this chart. When we really keep 2 Corinthians 9 and 13 in context, you know, who was it for? It was for the saints. 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 3, Romans 15, 25, Romans 15, 26, Romans 15 and 31. Where are they? At Jerusalem to be assisted or ministered to. The saints were to be ministered to. It was all at Jerusalem. Now, notice the saints were to be ministered unto, 2 Corinthians 8 and 4. 2 Corinthians 9 and 1, saints to be ministered unto. 2 Corinthians 9 and 12, the saints' wants were supplied. The saints were distributed unto, 2 Corinthians 9 and 13. The distribution was unto them, the saints, at Jerusalem, and unto all, that is, unto all saints. Now, all men must be determined then by the context. And I believe that it'll allow no other conclusion. But notice who the them and the all are in verse 14. We read, and by their prayer for you, which long after you for the exceeding grace of God in you, were sinners praying for the Christians, and by their prayer for you were sinners praying for the Corinthians. Not only that, but were they which long after you for the exceeding grace of God in you, were the sinners longing after the Corinthians? If all men includes unbelievers, people of the world, then it must be accepted that here we have unbelievers praying for believers. And I wonder if anyone is ready for that. All right, let us now notice how the Bible uses the phrase all men. In Acts 4 and 21 we read, so when they had further threatened them, they let them go, finding nothing how they might punish them because of the people. For all men glorified God for that which was done. Do you think that those who beat the apostles glorified God for that which was done? Why, no. Those who were Christians glorified God for that which was done, not those who beat Paul and John on this particular occasion. Note again in Acts 20 and 26, Paul's here talking to the elders at Ephesus, and he says in verse 25, "Now behold, I know that ye all among whom I have gone preaching the kingdom of God shall see my face no more." Verse 26, "Wherefore I take you to record this day that I am pure from the blood of all men. For I have not shunned to declare unto you all the counsel of God." Had Paul preached to every man everywhere? Why, no. This statement is qualified by verses 24, 25, and 26 in telling that he preached among different people, and he had begun preaching the kingdom of God among them, and he said that he would bear record this day that I am pure from the blood of all men. How many men? Those among whom he had preached. We must determine from the context who the all are. But again, in Hebrews 8 and verse 11, we want to show that the word all here is used with reference to some men and that it does not mean all mankind. We read, "And they shall not teach every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for all shall know me. From the least to the greatest." Does every man know about Christ today? Did every man upon the face of the earth know about Christ then? Why, no. But those to whom he had preached and those who accept him as the Christ. Now this is what it means to know Christ. That is to obey him. And that's the all here. The all must be determined from the context. But what about Galatians 6 and verse 10? Does it place upon the church the obligation to do good to both saint and sinner? I say no. For the simple reason that he is speaking in that verse of individual responsibility and not of church obligation. Now notice the verse. "As we have therefore opportunity, let us do good unto all men, and especially unto them who are of the household of faith." If some teach that this is church responsibility and that it includes unbelievers, then the opportunity is ever before it. It's not a matter of, as we have opportunity, let us do good unto all men, but it's a matter of the church using the opportunity that is ever present. Their pleas of CARE and of UNICEF and of the world in general to be heard and answered by the church. If Galatians 6 and 10 teaches church obligation. Of course it does not. But it does teach individual responsibility based upon the opportunities which come our way, and I plan to prove that. The parable of the Good Samaritan points out very, very clearly what the individual Christian should do when he has the opportunity to help a person who is not a Christian, as recorded in Luke 10, verse 29 through 37. The Samaritan poured oil and wine into the wounded man's wounds, placed him on his beast, and walked beside him, took the helpless man to an inn, paid the innkeeper so much with the promise that whatever other charges there might be, he would pay upon his return. I maintain that this was a picture of what life would be in Christ's kingdom, of an individual Christian, what he can do as doing good unto all men as he has opportunity. All right, let us read Galatians 6, verses 3 through 10, not just verse 10. Now I want you to notice the personal pronouns. In fact, yes, I'm going to put inflections upon them in reading it. "For if a man think himself to be something when he is nothing, he deceiveth himself, but let every man prove his own work, and then shall he have rejoicing in himself alone and not in another. For every man shall bear his own burden. Let him that is taught in the word communicate unto him that teacheth in all good things. Be not deceived, God is not mocked. For whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. For he that soweth to his flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption, but He that soweth to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap life everlasting. And let us not be weary in well-doing, for in due season we shall reap if we faint not. As we have therefore opportunity, let us do good unto all men, and especially unto them of the household of faith. I believe that one can clearly see that these verses deal with individual action. I know that the letter was addressed to the churches, but such a letter can set forth also individual responsibility, and I'll prove that maybe in some of the questions, if not before. But the book of Acts was addressed to an individual, yet it deals much with the church. How are we to know when the instructions are individual or collective? Well, I think Johnny had an excellent talk last night and on interpretation. By observing the context and studying to rightly divide the word of truth and applying it to ourselves. But the question is often asked, when does verse 6 of Galatians 6 authorize individual support of a preacher or from a common fund? And it says, let him that is taught in the word communicate unto him that teacheth in all good things. I unhesitatingly say that was individual support of a preacher. Unhesitatingly, I say that. But by such scriptures as 2 Corinthians 11 and 8, I also learned that it is scriptural for a church to support a preacher. But for those who want to make Galatians 6 and 10 church action, I ask, I believe, the crowning question. Are verses 12 and 13 of Galatians 6 dealing with individual or church action? Well, do you circumcise churches? Well, you see, that's what he's talking about, individual action. It'd be pretty hard to circumcise the female membership. But let us notice now the church and non-believers. I'm not concerning myself today with what an individual Christian may do. I'm discussing the work of the local congregation, that is, a collective action of Christians. Individual action is the distributive action of Christians. But the collective actions, therefore, all passages dealing with individual actions, such as Galatians 6 and 10, James 1 and 27, are irrelevant. James 1 and 27 says, pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this, to visit the fatherless and widows in their afflictions, and to keep himself unspotted from the world. James 1 and 27 does not authorize a group of Christians to do anything, for it says, himself, not a, that is, an individual, not a group, keep himself pure. Certainly the church should be pure, but that is taught by such scriptures as Ephesians 5, 26 and 27. It's often argued that since 1 Timothy 5 and 16 mentions the church care of widows, and James 1, 27 lists widows and the fatherless together, then the church may take care of or for the children. But you know, there are two widows that are mentioned in 1 Timothy 5 and 16. First of all, the one for whom the individual is responsible. And then secondly, the one who is a responsibility of the church. Now, since James 1 and 27 is obviously emphasizing individual responsibility, it's much more reasonable to me to conclude that the widows mentioned there are those of class 1 of 1 Timothy 5 and 16, for whom the individual is responsible. That being true, the widows and the fatherless of James 1, 27 are to be cared for by the individuals. But when we contribute into the common treasury of the church, this money becomes the Lord's money in a peculiar sense. The Lord's money may be spent only as the Lord is directed to do the work that He has authorized as head of the church. The individual must give account of the use of his own money, as Johnny mentioned about stewardship last night. But when his money is contributed, it comes under the power or control of the church. And since Christ is the head of the church, the money must be used only as the head directs. And God has never charged the church with caring for the world's need. God has never charged the church with caring for the world's need. but he has charged it with preaching the gospel to the world, benevolent organizations and works, the Red Cross, the American Cancer Society, the March of Dimes, etc., separate from the church, have a right to exist, I believe, because the church is not a glorified benevolent organization. It's wholly spiritual in its outreach to the world. In its work, the church is all-sufficient as an institution to preach the gospel, void of any assistance from any missionary society. But it becomes more apparent daily that America cannot financially underwrite the developing nations, and neither can she feed the entire world with no remuneration. If you don't believe it, ask the American farmer. But if a materialistic nation cannot feed the world, the church surely cannot feed the world, even if commissioned to do such, of which it is not. Because the church was never commissioned nor designed to function as a worldwide benevolence society, and because material benevolence is not her mission, brethren err when they try to make it thus for any country, developed or undeveloped. The care of the needy is a duty of general scope and nature in society. Many organizations exist for the care of the needy, and they're not interfering with the mission of the church. We read, I want to give a quote from James Burton Kaufman in his commentary on Romans, page 499. He says, "The Gentile Christians of the ancient Roman Empire were not laid under tribute for the purpose of helping to support the relief load in the city of secular Jerusalem. And likewise, the church of the present time should plan some nobler work than that of merely carrying the bedpan for a sick society, a role to which some sociologists would restrict the holy mission of the church." Unquote. The resources of the church would be exhausted before it ever got started, taking care of all the indigent, the maimed, the mentally incompetent, the blind, the destitute, the disabled, the deserted dependents of society today. It could not do the work which God has assigned it if it should undertake such a burden of benevolence. God said for the church not to be charged with the burden of benevolence that belonged to individuals, that it might care for those whose care it has been charged with by the divine will in 1 Timothy 5 and 16. The primary work of the church is spiritual, concerned with the salvation of the souls of men, its mission, and to be discharged by the teachings and the preaching of the gospel, 1 Timothy 3 and verse 15. What about victims of calamities? What about the orphans or victims of calamities? May the church contribute from its treasury to feed hungry victims of calamities, earthquakes, typhoons, and the like, who are not members of the church. Now, I believe in order to really place this in its proper perspective today, suppose that these unfortunate small children are in the home of a Baptist preacher or of a kind old Catholic priest. He's taken in more than he can take care of, and they're really in need. Now, the preacher or priest have taken on more than they can feed and clothe. Could the church relieve that need? Could the church take money from the church treasury to help anyone who is not a Christian in case of calamity? Because the man who took them in was a good man. He's a caring man in case of a typhoon, if he is really in need. Can the church assist needy Baptist, Methodist, Catholic members individually, but not collectively? All right, let us notice then the issue is the use of the Lord's money. To illustrate, I know of no scriptural objection to the Red Cross, an organization, as long as it stays in its place. But if the Red Cross should begin to accept funds from churches of our Lord, then the organization and its method of finance, the entire arrangement, would become unscriptural. Can you not see that this whole issue of benevolence towards those who are not Christians is a part of the social gospel concept? The whole issue is a part of the social gospel concept, a belief that the church was designed to serve the body and the needs of man in this world, his physical needs. God never intended that the church serve as a glorified Red Cross or a sanctified Salvation Army. Christianity is a religion of authority. We're not compelled to prove the use of the treasury for the sustenance of non-members wrong. I'm not compelled to prove that wrong today. Those who propose or practice such are compelled to prove such scripture, to take the Bible and prove it to be right. Did you realize that there is no specific command or example of a congregation caring for orphans in the entire Bible? Not one. And neither is it inferred that congregations were to ever take the oversight of such. There is no teaching which specifically authorizes a congregation to engage in child care. There are some commands to individuals, but even in the individual realm, God never expected more of a man than he can perform. God qualified that by saying, as we have opportunity. That is what that man can perform. Now, I feel compelled to say some things in conclusion tonight on institutional care and some things that go against my grain. I feel compelled to say, aside from the scriptures, as I said, I want to make some observations and comments concerning institutional care. Anyone knows that a child growing up in an institution is handicapped. It grows up under the emotional strain of knowing, or at least thinking, that no one wants it. And it cannot be a part of a normal home. In fact, on Channel 3 TV in Springfield, Missouri, for the last few weeks, some of you have probably been seeing, I watch the news just partly for that every night, and it makes my heart almost tear out. But from Springfield Children's Songs, 30 children's wishes for Christmas. And I hadn't sent them no wishes for Christmas, but I've been wanting to send them something, I freely confess. But you know, there, every one of them have some emotional problems of wanting to be at home. They've been taken out of homes, and they really have some problems dealing with it. That they're being good to them there, but they have some problems. But according to Lewis R. Turcotte, director of Tulsa Family and Children's Service, quoting from the Simpson-Britnell debate, page 137, my source, 70% of the children who spend a year or more in an institution remain public charges for life. And 80% develop some type of emotional disturbance. 8 out of 10 being normal when they arrive. Tulsa Tribune, December the 4th, 1959. Thurston said, the dependent child, pages 2 and 4, sets forth these levels of child care. First level, independent home. Second level, supplemented home. Third level, foster home. Fourth level, institutional home. The orphan asylum care is the lowest level of child care permitted in any civilized country. It's the lowest level permitted. Now, in February the 17th, 1983, Gospel Advocate ran an article on the Tennessee children's homes. And he said, Tennessee's orphans' home has recently begun a new program for the care of children with a virtual disappearance of orphans, but large increases in dependent and neglected children needing care. We have implemented a program involving three basic changes. But one of these was family-type units to provide our children with more of a family experience. During the time they live with us, we've changed our dorms into group homes. The idea is to move away from the orphanage-type operation to a family setting. Each unit is being remodeled to function more as a normal home. Each group has a Christian couple to serve as role models to the children. Each unit then worships, works, plays, and eats together as a family. To reflect this new approach, we have changed our name to Tennessee Children's Home. And they're getting away from the name, even orphan homes. First he says there's a shortage, and then, now this is the oldest home among churches of Christ. 73 years, it said, in their 73 years, they've cared for 2,500 children. Well, that's only 34 children a year, and they don't tell even the financial cost or the division that it caused. I misplaced an article that I wanted to, where the state of Texas has stopped its. I wanted to document it in the study, and so I'm quoting from the shoulder now. But you know, the state of Texas has ceased to have its state-supported orphan homes because the shortage of orphans, but not just that. It said the foster homes, the success rate was far greater than institutional care. Institutional care doesn't work. All right, I'm going to close with a little quote now. This year is not a pretty quote at all. And I don't like to leave bad taste on endings, but it ain't all over till, as the song says, the fat lady sings, and it's not all over here until the questions. But the Child Haven affair in Huntsville Times, and you might have read about it, an Associated Press column, it says, a Cullman County, Alabama grand jury indicted three people after an investigation into complaints of child abuse at the Child Haven Child Home, a Church of Christ facility. Two Cullman men were arrested Thursday on the indictments, 55-year-old J.B. Alexander on charges of second-degree sodomy and 27-year-old John Simmons on charges of child abuse. And the third person wasn't identified. The grand jury acted after the Department of Pensions and Security investigated complaints of harsh and humiliating punishment by staff members of the home. Seven employees were fired after the department probed. Its child home licensing supervisor, Virginia Gorman, said then that the agency was satisfied with the home's corrective action. But the grand jury goes on to report that they recommended that all cottage parents, social workers, and top administrative people be replaced within 90 days. Well, I'm not going to read the rest of that, but what I'm going to read now is a dialogue between Ken Green, who writes in Searching the Scriptures, and this was September 1984, and between a brother who was raised, a brother Holt, who was raised in that institution. It's been a similar institution. These abuses have happened throughout the country. But now, I want you to get from one who has been there what it's like. I'm going to use my fingers to back which one's talking. Ken says, Jack, can you hear me okay? Yes, I can. Tell us something about yourself and your association with the Child Haven Orphans Home. I spent 10 years at Child Haven between 1963 and 1972. I think the very first thing that I would say in relationship to the charges that are being brought up is that the problems at Child Haven are nothing new. They've been going on since the time that I was there. So little children have been facing this kind of abuse, both mental and physical abuse, for all of these years at Child Haven. So I think this is important to point out and to remember in relationship to my personal experiences at Child Haven. I can testify to personal cases of physical abuse and what I would now term mental abuse as well. I think the physical and mental abuse, not only of myself, but of my brothers and sisters and others that I've kept track of since I left Child Haven, has continued to bear many bad fruits in our lives after we left Child Haven. I have suffered severe bouts of depression, which I believe are related to my years at Child Haven. Beyond that, because of the situation of group living or group institutional care, it's very hard to teach children how to have a proper perspective of what family life is. Therefore, in forming my own family, this has presented a great deal of problems to me in that area. I think basically what I would say is that abuse of this kind is certainly a very real possibility in these types of homes, and more we're seeing the civil government as they move away from this type of care to what they consider to be better types of care, such as the foster home. While, of course, there's still the danger of this kind of abuse happening, it happens much less frequently in those kind of arrangements for caring children. Okay, an argument is often made that the orphan home is simply the home restored. Here's a child who has lost his home in this institution. is the home restored, and that the church has as great an obligation of supporting that institution, the home restored, as it has to support a destitute family who are members of the church. I infer from what you said that you wouldn't quite go along with this concept of the institution being the home restored. No, sir, it restores, perhaps we might say, the physical aspects of life. It can adequately provide food and clothing, but in no way can it substitute for the personal attention that a mother and father or family situation can provide. When you're caring for a mass amount of children, you have a situation that is tantamount, perhaps comparable rather to the military situation, where a great deal of regimentation, a great deal of that sort of an attitude has to prevail just for order to be maintained, and therefore there's a lack of emotional support that young children need. The personal attention that they need, the family closeness that they need, all of these things are missing from the institution. Now you say you spent 10 years at Child Haven's Orphans Home. Were you in any other institutional homes or foster homes? No, I was not. You had brothers and sisters who were also there. How many brothers and sisters did you have? Well, he had one sister and two brothers, and they had some of the same predicament. I'm going to have to hurry. He asked him, how did you wind up there? What was the family situation? He said, it's really a misturn to call these homes orphan homes in the first place. From my own personal experience, I only knew one, what I would call a true orphan. That is a person whose parents had died or of that type of situation. In my case, my father was an alcoholic, and he beat my mother, and they ended up having a divorce. And our grandparents gained custody of the children. The divorce process and the beatings my mother took from my father caused her to have a mental breakdown. All right, I'm going to not tell the rest of that. He says, okay, you mentioned a moment ago about having observed abuse, and I think you experienced abuse. Could you be a bit more specific as far as the kind of abuse you observed and experienced? Well, the major abuse that I experienced myself was simply beatings. Now, of course, we believe strongly in discipline, but I'm talking about, for example, a razor strap being applied to one's back and buttocks approximately 130 times on occasions. I can remember mornings, for example, when I woke up in the morning and the oozing from my wounds from the strap on my back and buttocks stuck to the sheet. It's kind of equal to pulling a Band-Aid off of a fresh wound, getting out of bed in the morning after being beaten like that. The beatings generally were held in the cottage public area, and on many occasions we were assembled to witness them. I suppose there's a warning mechanism to keep us in line, so to speak. And so this was the most common type of abuse, children being forced to do things that were against their will, beyond the normal things that parents need to have their children do. Standing in places and spots for hours at a time, and punishment that involved physical labor for 14 to 16 hours a day, and these type of things also were involved. Well, there's a lot more that I want to read, but there's some of it I can't read in this mixed audience, and I don't intend to read. But now, I've read you about a third of it right there. That's, I oppose institutional care apart from the scriptures, and I make no bones about it.